My guest on the phone is reporter Elizabeth Miller. Thanks for joining me, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much for having me, Gavin.
Elizabeth is an independent journalist who has written about environmental issues for Backpacker, Outside, High Country News, Undark, and other outlets. She's won awards from the Society of Professional Journalists and the Association of Alternative News Media. And from where are you speaking to us today, Elizabeth?
So I'm based in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
And we'll get to wildfire season in the second half of the show, but let's start with your new feature, The Losing Coast, for The Statesider. The Statesider, a weekend travel section for all of America, is online at statesider.us. And your story is about the impacts of climate change for residents along the Louisiana coastline, and that's not just human residents. For you as a reporter, how did this particular story begin? You usually cover the Mountain West.
Right. So I was on the phone with an ecologist on the Gulf Coast working on a story for Backpacker about offshore oil drilling and coastal national parks. And we just had sort of started talking about the nature of change in the universe and these things and climate change. And he said, you know, I can take you to some places where you can see climate change actually happening. And, you know, I've lived in the Mountain West my entire life. I grew up in Western Colorado. I moved to New Mexico about 5 years ago. And here it sort of feels like it's this abstract concept that you sort of see, like you start to notice change when you start to wonder, like, wasn't it different before? You know, didn't it snow more when I was a kid? Didn't that pond used to freeze? Didn't the winters used to be colder? And so the idea of coming somewhere where you could actually see the change like happening in real time or sort of watch pieces of an ecosystem breaking apart, basically, that was just really compelling to me as someone who feels like bearing witness is an important part of the work that I do as a journalist.
You write that every map you look at of Louisiana is a lie. Why is that?
That is because coastal Louisiana is changing faster than the maps can be reprinted or even the maps that you download on a GPS can keep up in a lot of cases. So we picture Louisiana as this boot shape kind of state, right? But really the bottom part of the boot has been eroding for the last century, and we've lost 2,000 square miles of solid land. So if you can get a view of that landscape just with what you could actually walk on, you'd see that there's, you know, it's not a boot anymore. It looks more like an arc through the middle where that land has started to erode. And so I was out in the field in, you know, traveling through some of the bayous, and kind of to make the point, Scott Eustace with Healthy Gulf, who was showing me around, and we were looking at some of these different wetlands restoration projects and some of the work the state is trying to do to slow this land loss. He pulls out his GPS and shows me the screen, and it indicates that we're in a channel, and I'm looking around at nothing but open water.
Yeah. You write that almost 2,000 square miles of wetlands have disappeared from Louisiana over the last century. That's according to the USGS. And that as much or more could disappear in the next 50 years. This is one of my favorite lines in your whole piece, Elizabeth. You wrote, "Today's maps won't just look a little off. They'll look like the product of myths."
Mm-hmm. Right, right. It's a number of things that are sort of all coming into play in the wetlands, and that's kind of why they are eroding as quickly and as extensively as they are. You know, it's that the Mississippi River for millennia was pouring pretty much a continent's worth of sand and clay and mud into the Delta. And when we levied that river to turn it into a shipping channel and to stop it from flooding farms and houses and towns that had come up along the Mississippi River, we cut off a lot of that sediment supply. I think it's something like 30% of what used to hit the Delta still gets out into the Gulf of Mexico. And so that wetland system sort of relied on that constant recharge of sediment. And without that, it started to sink. And then we drilled for oil and gas. And that takes out this subsurface layer of liquid that was holding some of the land up. And so the land sinks even further, and every oil well needed to have a canal drilled to access it. And so that sort of like cut all these vertical line channels into the wetlands. And so you look, you know, you look in places and there's like a grid cut through the landscape where they just drilled, you know, burrowed straight through to drill these wells. And so that, like, that open access point lets more seawater in. And then we've also got rising sea levels and increasing storms, and all of these things are compounding in this one landscape.
Another thing I learned from your story is what actually happens as the sea encroaches on the delta.
Right, right. That whole process of, like, the it sort of, like, swallows the ground from the bottom up, right? Like, it hits the lowest root systems first, and that's usually the trees. And so they have these what they call ghost forests out there, where it's just standing dead tree trunks from sea pines that used to be out along the bayous, and they've been hit with so much salt water that they just can't survive anymore. And then it comes up a little bit higher, and the brush that was out there dies off. And, you know, some of the indigenous communities that have lived in that area, you know, lived on a lot of berry bushes and could just naturally forage for a lot of things that grew on this landscape. And, you know, that's sort of the next thing to go. And then you end up with these grasses that are just kind of like up to their necks in water, essentially being drowned by standing water and unable to continue to live, and then unable to hold the land in place. And so it just kind of, it dies from the ground up, and then it just sort of starts washing away from there because there's nothing, you know, as we know in the West, like if you don't have vegetation to hold the land in place, it erodes a lot easier.
My guest is reporter Elizabeth Miller. We're talking about her piece, The Losing Coast, online at statesider.us. So talk to us about the travel you did for this story. For example, you start off getting in a boat on what you call a quiet bayou, an hour's drive south of New Orleans. And at first I thought, oh, this really isn't that far from the city. But then you ventured far beyond what I had imagined.
Yeah, we went kind of as far as they would let the boat, as far as they would let us convince them to take the boat, in sort of a backwards framing. I'd gone with Scott Eustace, who's with Healthy Gulf, which is an organization that advocates for the coastal environment and coastal communities and trying to make sure that the policies coming out of the federal and state government to address what's going on there, equitably address the wildlife and the air and water quality and the people who live out there. So I'd been going back and forth with Scott Eustace, this local community scientist and community activist, about what to do and how best to see some of the work that had been underway, because I'd read about, you know, like 41,000 acres of restoration projects, but what does that really look like? And so we decided to hire someone who spends most of his time driving this little, like, low-speed motorboat around the bayous with people who fish for speckled trout and redfish, and convinced him to do this scenic tour of wetlands restoration sites. And so it started out as this pretty mellow, like, cruise through the bayous, and we're just kind of, you know, heading past some of these grasslands and talking about some of the weird issues that come up, like, you know, if the land belonged to somebody before and then the land disappeared and now the state has come back in and poured enough sediment that there's land there again, like, who gets to put a no trespassing sign on it? You know,
right.
Like, is it the state or is it the private landowner who used to own that land? And there are a lot of scattered fishing camps, they call them. So they're like houses way up on stilts, all over throughout this part of Louisiana. And so we're sort of like passing by these, you know, beautiful, like, little, like, ocean top cabins effectively, and looking at, you know, places to fish and places to watch the water and watch the sun kind of move over this bay. And it's just beautiful, and motoring through some of the villages that are built along these canals, you know, sort of treat it like that's Main Street. Right. And
right.
So all the house fronts, like all the house fronts and village fronts face the canal. And so you're looking at, you know, signs advertising boat, you know, boat tours, and people are sitting on their front porches and kind of waving as we go by. And it just feels like a place where time works on a different scale. Like, it just all seems to slow down when you get out there, and it's just struck me as so beautiful.
One other question and then, about that, yeah. Elizabeth, just if people go to statesider.us, and we'll link to this at the Canadian Case site, that you can also, people can see some of your photos. Can you describe for the radio audience a ghost forest?
Sure. A ghost forest, these are out in either the barrier islands or in some of the bayous where salt water has come in. And so it's just standing dead pine trees. And so instead of, I mean, it almost in some ways looks like a wildfire scar, because they're trees that have been stripped of all foliage and they're just these black sticks. And we happen to catch a couple in osprey nesting season. And so they had these like little clumps of osprey nests up at the top, and we sort of were watching the mother circle the nest and keep a close eye on us and sort of squawk if we got too close. But they just look like a totally dead forest where nothing is green anymore. It's just gray and black and white.
I think I interrupted you. Do you remember what you're about to say next after talking about Main Street and people waving and the fishing cabins? And then I was like, tell me about a ghost forest, but you had another thought that I interrupted.
No, that's okay. I was going to say we finished the tour with Scott, who I went out with, talking our boat captain, Chad, into going like way out to the southern edge of Louisiana to where they dredged up some sand and rebuilt one of the barrier islands. And these islands are kind of like the first line of defense for the wetland system, because they start slowing storms down and buffering some of the storm surge, like the big waves that will come inland with any kind of hurricane or tropical storm that's coming in off the coast. So we went all the way down through way more open water than that boat was meant to go through to go look at this island and kind of watch some pelicans fly by it and some dolphins, and then speed back to the dock because it was getting dark and there was a storm rolling in.
Well, so what is Healthy Gulf's role on sort of the environmental advocacy or the community advocacy side? It seemed like they were an important piece of the puzzle in your learning about this subject in terms of, you know, going beyond a travel story to being a reporting about climate. But you have a knack in your career of being able to sort of cross over between someone who wants to read environmental stuff or someone who wants to read a travel piece. And this is another one of those examples where your writing invites us along on your travel, and then we learn facts and figures, you know. So, but what is the role with Healthy Gulf? Are they well known? Are they respected? Are they sort of a niche? You know, how do they fit into the environmental and community advocacy side?
So when I was planning this trip to the Gulf Coast, you know, like I was mapping out who I was going to meet with and talk to before I even left the grounds. And of course, I was going to go meet with this ecologist who'd said, like, I'll show you around. And then I was calling all these other community organizations, trying to get a better sense for, like, not just how the landscape was affected, but how the people were affected. And Scott Eustace's name came up over and over and over and over again. Mm. You know, like everyone I talked to said, like, you got to call Scott. And so this really, like, I went down for a different boat trip that went out into the barrier islands, and getting to go into the bayous with someone from Healthy Gulf was this like remarkable bonus that showed up when I was actually already in the Gulf. So it stunned me that it worked out as well as it did, because it doesn't always go that way.
And not best laid plans in this case. It was something you picked up along the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it isn't only environmentalists and local residents who want to see solutions along the coastline. And this was, in some ways, for me, maybe some of the more hopeful aspect of the sort of solutions that we're trying to, you know, learn more about, too. And you write about the clear economic imperative. And it seems like so often, if you can make an economic case for restoration or environmental justice, that's going to go further than simply, hey, we should help people or animals or nature. So talk about the case being made for this fight and why this is such an important economic argument, no matter someone's beliefs.
Right, right. So I went to the LSU Center for River Studies in Baton Rouge, which is sort of where the state is mounting its argument for this. And they point out that, like, we levied the Mississippi River because it's such an incredibly, like, it's become an incredibly important shipping channel for our nation. And it's like, you know, 30% of the commercial fishing in the nation is done out of the Gulf Coast, and 60% of our nation's grain moves through the Gulf Coast. And, you know, so if you like your oysters on the half shell and your shrimp cocktail, this is a vital landscape for you. But it's also, it's also the port that moves 20% of the nation's oil and gas and, you know, 500 million tons of cargo. So there's just, like, if we watched this ecosystem fall apart, it wouldn't just be coastal Louisiana that lost. There would be ripple effects throughout America.
And yet you write, many of the communities that the state says it can't afford to save are, you can guess, listeners, rural, poor, African-American, and Native American communities.
Right. There was a study out of Tulane University that looked at the Coastal Restoration Plan and analyzed the demographics of all of the people who were left outside the levees and who were reached. You know, in some cases, like, the Coastal Restoration Plan reaches some communities with a plan that's just, we're going to make sure your highway is in really good shape so that you can evacuate during the next hurricane quickly. And there is, you know, there's sort of a grim contest between communities for who were the first domestic climate refugees. There's a village in Alaska that had to be relocated because of climate change. And then there's Ile de Jean Charles in Louisiana, which was an indigenous community that used to have 24 square miles of space. And now they're down to like a mile long and a half a mile wide. And, you know, all the orchards have become ghost forests, effectively. Like, all the orchards are gone. And when the quality of the water changes, the kind of fishing you can do changes. And so, you know, just the whole system around how they live was disrupted. And so the federal government is paying to relocate that entire community farther inland. I talked to people who live out on the coast. I went through one of the indigenous villages, and there are some people who feel really committed to trying to adapt and stay, and some people who feel like being moved as a community is the best possible outcome, and some people who are really just focusing on trying to preserve, like, pieces of their cultural legacy with the assumption that, like, there's nothing we can do to, like, save the community and save the culture. We just have to try to record it so that someone in the future has an ability to look back at what we used to have.
That's reporter Elizabeth Miller. The story is The Losing Coast, online at statesider.us. And it looks like we have about 8 minutes left in the program. I want to completely shift gears and talk about your latest story for New Mexico In Depth, online at nmindepth.com. The headline is COVID-19 Pandemic Complicates 2020 Wildfire Season. I want to start by asking you simply, what dates do we consider the wildfire season? They've already begun, right?
Right. I'm based in New Mexico. We have had multiple red flag warning days today, this week rather. And so we're already at really high risk conditions for wildfire in New Mexico. I know Colorado saw pretty good snowpack, but not great snowpack, and so is starting to see that coming. I think we sort of understand, like, there are two, depending on how far north you go, there kind of can be two peaks in fire season. There's, you know, right coming up now as the snow starts to melt out and it greens up, and then summer rainstorms hit and that potential can mellow out a little bit in some places. And then you can see another peak in the fall. But Colorado, I typically think of as more like June, July peak summer season, peak fire season.
Well, why do infectious diseases spread rapidly through fire camps? What makes fire camps particularly high risk?
So in an effort to kind of consolidate logistics and, you know, coordinate teams of people that are often several hundred strong, the approach from the interagency fire centers has been to, like, make everyone live in the same space. So you get hundreds of firefighters camped, like, one tent fly rubs up against the next tent fly kind of close.
By design.
And they're served, like, buffet-style meals, and they're camped in the woods where there isn't a lot of running water, and so washing your hands for 20 seconds just isn't going to be an option. So there's all this, like, proximity stuff, and there's shared equipment and people in vehicles, that, you know, 20 at a time. And then there's also the fact that a fire camp is close to a fire, and we're finding more and more research that shows that that long-term chronic exposure to particulate matter and wildfire smoke can be really detrimental to your health in ways that can make you more susceptible to viruses and to respiratory infections, which means COVID-19 is an added risk, like both in terms of them spreading it among themselves and in terms of firefighters being harder hit if they do happen to come down with a case of it.
And what are authorities doing to change how wildland firefighters work?
Well, they're shifting both the approach to fire camps and then approach to fires this season. So fire camps are adopting their bureaucratic language for it is module of one, which is that they are putting together a crew of firefighters and you will just stay with your crew of about 20 people throughout the season instead of like moving around and taking different tasks and getting different experience and leadership positions and opportunities to learn from other groups. They're just going to stay with their crew and try to be really insulated that way. There's talk on like how to change, you know, like one of the things that we do across the West is that we all sort of help each other out because fire season does come at different times in different states. So like New Mexico's is now, Colorado's will be a little bit later, California's is later still. And so it's not uncommon for wildfire fighters from New Mexico and Colorado to go to California during their season. But this is the kind of movement that we don't really want to see during a pandemic. So they're talking about like how to isolate a little bit better and how to keep, you know, if a crew does have to move from New Mexico, like how to keep them from too much contact with the crew in California. And then they're also implementing all these protocols like temperature testing and routine screenings, and anyone who's new to a crew has to self-isolate for 14 days. And they're just really, it changes a lot of the teamwork and team building that they're doing. And then New Mexico at least has adopted an approach of suppressing all fires immediately.
Like right, I was going to say, if we zoom out from the kind of detail level that you're reporting on to the kind of what the average listener to this show might already be familiar with, typically small wildfires, you might let them burn, right? I mean, that's
right.
That's a change. And then the other one is prescribed burns, of course, are usually very effective and a big part of that environmental approach to forestry. And so Do prescribed burns then also get delayed or rescheduled?
Right. Yes, we're trying to minimize smoke exposure for everyone, for wildfire fighters and for communities, and so because it can exacerbate your case of COVID-19, according to some of the preliminary research that's coming out of places like Harvard, and so we're not doing prescribed burns this year in a lot of places because it just felt like too much to add that burden of smoke potentially to communities that are already dealing with the pandemic.
Well, before we go, one last question is around this Fire on the Land workshop for journalists that you recently participated in from the Institute for Journalism and Natural Resources. And we don't have time to get into the whole list of everything you learned, but what would be like one of your key takeaways for thinking about fire in this new reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that has really stuck with me is that our approach is to go inside if there's a wildfire in your area and you're trying to reduce your smoke exposure. But that really only works well if you've got the right level of air filters. And a lot of buildings are built with like, you know, a level 8 filter and they need a level 13 filter. So it's worth, like, if you're in any sort of leadership role in your building, checking what kind of filter you have and whether that's really a fine enough level to take out some of the particulate matter. And then looking in your own home as well to see if it might be worth investing in an air purifier if you feel like you're going to be chronically exposed to smoke, just as that extra measure to protect your lungs in a year when we've got so many challenges to them.
Well, we have to leave it there. Reporter Elizabeth Miller, it's always a pleasure to have you on KD&K. Thank you so much. Just to recap for folks, we were just now talking about her latest piece for New Mexico In Depth, which is online at nmindepth.com. indepth.com, COVID-19 pandemic complicates 2020 wildfire season. And we started off the show today speaking about her piece for The Statesider, a weekend travel section for all of America, online at statesider.us. And I just can't wait to see what you write next. Thank you so much for your time, Elizabeth, and keep up the great work.
Thanks for having me, Gavin. Take care.